We're going to be in Revelation 14 this morning. We are making progress. I know. And we're on track. We're going to be ending before the end of the year. So that's wonderful. Revelation 14. The Bible ends with a strange book, in case you haven't noticed over the last 10 weeks. It's a letter that's bursting with symbols and colors and patterns. It's overflowing with memorable characters and battles and beasts. It's telling this story with scenes of there are scenes of unspeakable darkness, but it's also a story with the happiest ending of them all. It's the chapter that we're reading today, that we're looking at today, that we're hearing from John today is essentially the end of a small cartoon that's been taking place right in the middle of Revelation. In chapters 12 through 14, John has paused in the story that he's been telling, Spielberg or Scorsese or someone using a flashback or something. The screen's changed and he's been diving into something akin to mythic sort of animation. And he's been circling back around. He's been circling and looking at it from different angles on something really, really important. He's been wanting to emphasize the central revelation of Revelation, the scroll that had been unsealed back in chapters 5 through 7 that John received from an angel and eats in Revelation 10, and now he's making known to his churches. John's wanting to circle back around on the revelation of that scroll, on how God saves the world, and reflect on it from different angles. John had started revealing the scroll, God's plan to save the world, back in chapter 11, where he told us a short story, a masterpiece of a story, really, of biblical allusions and stuff. It's a short parable about two witnesses. He's told a story, it would seem, about the church itself embodying the love of Jesus to the point of death. And that love, embodied by witnesses to the point of death, accomplishes what nothing else in the world really could accomplish. No act of judgment, no show of force, no plague of Egypt can do what love to the point of death can do. That's what love to the point of death accomplishes. The witness of the church, back at the end of that little story, it sees this huge, gigantic, symbolic number of people turning from darkness. It's a moment of hope in Revelation. Turning from darkness, this was in chapter 11, verse 13. They turn from darkness and they embrace God. They embrace true life. When the church, I think John's saying, this is the revelation of Revelation, when the church follows the pattern of the Lamb, when we follow the pattern of the Lamb, wherever he goes, even into death, love to the point of death, lives are changed. You want to change the world? It's not through politics. It's not through coercion. It's not through forcing somebody to buy your point of view. You want to change the world, you love to the point of death. You become a witness, a martyr is the same word for Jesus. That's how the world is changed. And ever since that eye-opening revelation of Revelation in chapter 11, John has been circling back around it with a strange dreamlike cartoon that reflects on this from different angles. He's told us about chapter 12, he told us about a very real, very historical baby whose very arrival, very birth into the world defeated all of the forces of evil backstage in heaven. He's introduced us to great symbolic signs in heaven. A dazzling, beautiful woman that seems to represent the people of God. A terrible dragon and its two beasts that wage war on the people of God. The forces of evil from everywhere. This dragon from heaven, the beast from the earth, and the beast from the sea. All of them have been conspiring against and actually conquering those who love God. That sounds a little bit of the story of the two witnesses. Those who love life, those who love the Lamb, are being conquered by the forces of evil. It's been a surreal and strange couple of chapters in an already strange book. And in chapter 14, this is the moment, I told you guys that it was coming a couple of weeks ago, but this is the part where the mythic animation, it starts to like blend together with the main story that John's been telling. John's been telling kind of a big story, and he changed, but now it's like the two are coming together. And so after the woman in the wilderness, after the dragon waging war against God's people, after two beasts that seem like their idolatrous government and local culture rising up to fight God's people, John tells us this, chapter 14, verse 1. "Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a sound from heaven, like the roar of rushing waters and like a peal of thunder. The sound I heard was was like that of harpists playing their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. These are those who did not defile themselves with women, for they remained virgins. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They were purchased from among mankind and offered as firstfruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless. Then I saw another angel flying in midair, and he had the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. He said in a loud voice, 'Fear God and give him glory.'" That's exactly what happened at the end of the tale of the two witnesses, by the way. That's people turning from evil and embracing God. "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water." A second angel followed and said, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries." A third angel followed them and said in a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives its mark on their foreheads or on their hand, they too will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. They will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment will rise forever and ever. There will be no rest, day or night, for those who worship the beast and its image, or for anyone who receives the mark of its name. This calls for patient endurance on the part of the people of God who keep his commands and remain faithful to Jesus." Then I heard a loud voice from heaven say, "Write this, 'Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on.' Yes, this is the Spirit. They will rest from their labor, for their deeds will follow them." I looked, and there before me was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like a son of man, with a crown of gold on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. Then another angel came out of the temple and called in a loud voice to him who was sitting on the cloud, "Take your sickle and reap, because the time to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is ripe." So he who was seated on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was harvested. Another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Still another angel who had charge of the fire came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, "Take your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine, because its grapes are ripe." The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles, for a distance of 1,600 stadia. Stadia is like a unit of measure. It's basically like 180 miles. But that's not nearly as symbolic sounding as 1,600 stadia, 4 times 4 times 100. Have you ever heard an orchestra warming up, getting ready to play? The strings and the bass and the percussion are all making something that sounds like a controlled, chaotic racket. That, I think that might be something akin to what's happening right here. On a literary level, the climax of Revelation is coming very, very soon in chapter 16 through 20. The cosmos is going to pass through the cross. The evil and the enemy and his beasts are all going to be destroyed. Resurrection is going to flood the universe. The secret symphony of salvation is about to be played. The song of the universe is about to be sung. It's like John is hearing various parts of the orchestra warming up as heaven gets ready to play its symphony. Chapter 14 is a bit like one of those, I'm sorry that we don't have slides today. There was no internet access back there to get you slides for a visual aid on this, but chapter 14 is like one of those sweeping shots in a movie. You know, one of those that flies over mountains and over plains and maybe even into outer space. It's like just a sweeping shot. That's a bit what the movement of chapter 14 is like as John is hearing the orchestra warm up. The last couple of chapters, he's been watching a cartoon almost unfold in like a desert wilderness, and then on the seashore, and then on the land, the earth itself. And now John's being swept back up to heaven. There are three moments as the camera begins to sweep back up to heaven. As John is swept back up, there are three primary moments here. He finds himself moving upward on the land itself. On verse 1 with Mount Zion is where he finds himself. And then suddenly, verse 6, he's in midair with some angels. And then verse 14, he's on a white cloud with a view, verse 17, of the temple in heaven. These three moments are the moments where he's like hearing, I think, various parts of the orchestra begin to warm up. It sounds a little like a disjointed, confusing sort of racket until we begin to remember that a symphony supreme is about to be played. There's something really beautiful that's about to happen in the book of Revelation. It's going somewhere. He's on his way back to heaven, and something is about to happen. And chapter 14 is bridging the gap between where the world is and where the world is going. It's going somewhere majestic. I would say that the first part of the orchestra that he hears warming up is it's that first moment on Mount Zion. The verses 1 through 5, he begins to be swept upward back to heaven, and he finds himself on a high bit of earth, you know, on Mount Zion, that literal mountain outside of Jerusalem, or outside of Old Jerusalem, on which stood the temple. And now it's like a new temple's there. The Lamb and his followers are standing on that mountain. And at first, John, he sees them, but he can't make sense quite of what he's hearing. It just sounds like a racket, like disjointed. What is this? It's like, he describes it, verse 2, as like a rushing roar of a waterfall or like a crackling thunderstorm. But then he realizes that beneath the noise, there isn't chaos. Beneath all the noise that's flooding, threatens to overwhelm him, there's actually music. There's order. There's what I'm listening to. It actually sounds like the string section. It sounds like harpists playing their harps. There's this great uncountable army. We actually met it in chapter 7. There's this great, vast, uncountable army embodied in the symbolic number of 144,000. And they stand victorious on Mount Zion. That's what the army language, by the way, is what verse 4 is getting at. When it talks about them not defiling themselves and being virgins, that's the way that the Old Testament would frequently talk about a devout, ritually pure, like military force is what's being invoked right here. It sounded like an army roll call back in chapter 7, and sure enough, it's an army, a victorious army, standing on this mountain. And yeah, they're victorious, even though the enemy has been waging war against them, the end of chapter 12. Even though, verse 7 of chapter 13, even though the beasts are killing them, crushing them, conquering them, they are victorious. And singing. I get intrigued by stuff like this. Singing like a mysterious song, a secret song, a song that nobody can learn, verse 3, except those who have been redeemed. Only those, verse 4, who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. Even though there really is darkness in the world right now. There are really monsters and chaos and suffering and evil. Not only in like the world back then or like maybe in the world one day, if Revelation's pointing to that, but in our world, in our lives right now, there is darkness and evil, but there is something more real than the darkness. There's something There's order, music beneath the chaos. There is a song behind all of the noise, and it's haunting, isn't it? It is possible to learn that song. Follow the Lamb wherever he goes, and you will learn the song. It's not like as quick or as painless or as simple as like praying a prayer or checking off a list or I believe all the right things that are in some sort of document somewhere. You have to learn this song like over time, gradually. It's like a habit of our lives. But as we follow the Lamb wherever he goes, as we follow him further into love, painful love when it hurts, into self-giving, sacrificial, as we follow him even into death itself, we learn the song that the orchestra is warming up with. And that I think that brings us to the second moment where he hears bits of the orchestra warming up. He's swept up further, higher than any mountain. He's taken off Mount Zion, sea of earth, and he sees, verse 6, he sees angels flying in midair. He sees three of them. Maybe they're the woodwinds, you know, or something like that. Maybe the clarinets, the oboes, the flutes or something. I don't know why, because I find the woodwinds a lot of times are beautiful, but something about them haunts me a little bit. I don't know. I can find pipes can haunt some bit of my soul, so I'll call them the woodwinds. These angels have a beautiful, but it's haunting sound that they're making right here. It's such a beautiful sound, verse 6, because they are proclaiming an eternal gospel. They're proclaiming eternal good news to those who live on the earth. Verse 7, they're saying, fear God. discover the beginning of wisdom, is what they're saying. Fear God and give him glory. And those who do, you're going to find rest. Verse 12. It's the big picture of what they're saying. Fear God and give him glory, because the end of this section, verse 12, you will find rest if you do. Those who patiently remain faithful to Jesus, who you're going to rest from your labor. You're going to rest from suffering, from rest from fear. In the words of the lyrics of Les Mis, you're going to rest from pain and rest from wrong. Because, verse 13, because your deeds will follow you. Their deeds follow them. That's the reason they rest, is their deeds follow them. Even in death itself, they're going to be blessed. They're going to find rest because their deeds follow them. And I don't think John's saying right here that somehow these people did the right things to somehow get God on their side. That runs counter to the entire New Testament, to the entire gospel, really. No, God is already always on our side. He's already always on our side. That's the eternal gospel. That's the good news, that we are always invited to believe is already true. And as we begin to believe that good news, I think what happens is God's Spirit slowly, gradually, mysteriously, I don't understand any of this, mysteriously, I think he starts to teach us the song. He starts to bring all of our lives into alignment with what is true. What's good and beautiful and true with God himself. And that, of course, includes our actions. That, of course, includes our outer lives, what we do, our deeds. But deeds don't save anybody. That's not what this is getting at. They're saying that deeds, they're like an evidence of, an indicator of what's going on a really deep level, that God is forming us into the kinds of people who actually will enjoy his presence, who actually could rest if they were in the presence of love, because evidently not everybody can. That's the haunting bit of the woodwinds, isn't it? The terrifying part of the angels who are warming up, because they say, verse 11, this is moving into the middle of this little section, there will be no rest, verse 11, for those who love really a particular kind of woman, is what is the image being given right here. There's this woman, verse 8. There's this woman, Babylon the Great, Lady Babylon. She's some sort of adulterous woman with a drinking problem. This is the very first time that we're hearing about her. We'll be introduced more to her in chapter 17. But the orchestra, when I say the orchestra's getting ready, that's what I mean, is it's bringing together all sorts of bits that are going to form the climactic symphony of where Revelation is going. They're giving us a little taste of her story. This woman, Lady Babylon, she seems to like represent life that totally rejects, wants nothing to do with the purposes of God. Life in total opposition to God. And this woman, we're told in verse 8, is fallen. Fallen. She's coming to an end. She seems to represent Rome on some sort of level in chapter 17, but like other ancient cities in the Old Testament, she's described as falling by fire, by being destroyed by sulfur and brimstone. That's the way, and the terrifying thing is, that's the way that the no rest is described for those who love her. All that talk about burning sulfur and smoke rising forever, they're symbolic ways. You check notes, follow up on this. They're symbolic ways that the prophets used in the Old Testament to communicate the seriousness of rejecting God. the absolute dire seriousness of what it means to not to try to sing your own song, try to create your own reality of you want nothing to do with God. And as graphic and terrifying as burning sulfur sounds, it's worse. It's worse if our entire, it's a warning about something worse, about what our lives, about what the human about what human existence can become if we want nothing to do with God's purposes. Because what we do is we become in love with something that's fallen, something that cannot last, something that will forever destroy us. Life, I think he's saying life in opposition to God is a tortured existence. It's a tormented existence. It's an existence of self-chosen, self-centered, self-inflicted torment. It's haunting because even in the presence of love himself, verse 10, of the Lamb, this is still torment. They find no rest. It would seem that if you want to forever drink, verse 8, the maddening wine is what it's called, the maddening wine of a life in opposition to God, it seems like God will give it to you. It seems like God will give you what you want. He'll give you that wine. And then that brings us to the third moment of John rising in chapter 14. The third section of the orchestra that he hears warming up. It's these angels, verse 14 through 20. These angels preparing for harvest. They're like these angels who are banging the drums that the moment is almost here. The great holiday of the harvest time is about to arrive. We don't live in an agrarian society. We don't grow our own food. And so it's hard for us to imagine the excitement that harvest time brings. I have a difficult time. I'd go to like King Supers, you know, and grab something. But throughout human history, people have celebrated when the harvest comes. Harvest is when all the work finally pays off. Harvest is when there's nothing left to do but enjoy. Harvest is when we feast and we drink and we celebrate. I think Thanksgiving and Christmas coming up might be the closest thing that we have to harvest, but we don't usually spend much time worrying that the holidays might not arrive. That's the big difference between our holidays and the harvest. We don't worry that a swarm of locusts might destroy all of the turkey and dressing and stuffing, you know, and that it won't be there, and that we might start, and my children might start. We don't worry that the Christmas tree is going to wither away and die from lack of rain. We don't really worry about it. Our holidays almost always come right on time, free of any threat or worry or really even longing or waiting or desire. But harvest doesn't feel like a sure thing. It doesn't feel like a sure thing. It's something that you're longing for, that you're hoping to see. And when it arrives, you celebrate in a big, big way. These angels are like banging the drums saying, it's almost here. Maybe they're the percussion section. They're setting the pace, giving us a rhythm, saying it's almost here. The holiday of the harvest is about to arrive. The day that the people of God have been longing for, that we've been hoping to see, it's about to come because the church, the two witnesses, that dazzling woman, the 144,000, take your pick of images, because they loved to the point of death, because, verse 4, they were offered as a sacrifice of first fruits. They were just the beginning of the harvest. There's going to be, because they have done this, there is going to be an even bigger harvest arriving. The bang, the drum, it's almost here. Verse 15, the earth is ripe. It's full of people who revere God and love the Lamb. the percussion's like warming up, banging the drums, saying, bring in that harvest. It's time to feast. It is time to celebrate. Chapter 14 is an orchestra warming up and saying, this is where it's all headed. This is the song that's about to play. We're going to play the symphony of salvation, the secret song of those victorious martyrs on Mount Zion, the eternal good news of rest for all who follow the Lamb, the hymn of the harvest, a feast that never ends. Can we please get into chapters 15, 16, 17, 18, 19? Can we get started? Let's play this symphony. And they will. They will. The orchestra only warms up so long. The symphony is going to start. Next week, chapter 14 is going to give way to the rest of the book. One day, history itself is going to give way to this great day of God's love. But the path forward, the way that we get to a world remade by love, it's a hard road. The road to the harvest is a really hard road. It calls for patient endurance, verse 12, of those who are all those who cling to Jesus. We heard that last week in chapter 13, verse 10, and we heard it again this week. It requires patient endurance, I think, because next week we're going to see it, and we catch a glimpse of it, just a small glimpse of it here at the end of the chapter. Next week we're going to see seven bowls of wine. Verse 10 calls them the wine of God's fury, the wine of God's wrath. Or it is about to be poured out. It's like God's love fermented. God's love distilled into such a blistering vintage that it burns away everything that is not love. It's painful. It's painful. That's what's coming as part of the symphony. And it's like here at the end of chapter 14, we catch a glimpse. It's like we catch a glimpse of the wine being made, is what we catch a glimpse of here. It's the image of harvesting wheat is followed by a different kind of harvest, the harvest of grapes. It's the making of wine is what we have described right here. The common everyday process, verse 18, of gathering grapes, and then verse 19, crushing them in a wine press, is used as like an image of the symphony, of where God's plan is going. But I think I hold all this with an open hand. Few things in Revelation have I held with more of an open hand. I think this image of grapes and wine is so surprising because best I can tell, again, I'm holding all this with an open hand, but it doesn't seem like it's the blood of God's enemies that runs for 1600 stadia. That's my default way that I read it a lot of times. That's our instinct, I think, that the good news, the gospel, to take up your cross and follow Jesus, it's such a counterintuitive thing that it hasn't sunk into our imaginations that we read this and we think, yes, God is going to crush his enemies and make their blood flow. But if you read it, if you read Revelation really carefully, it doesn't seem like the enemies of God are the grapes. The enemies of God aren't the ones, it doesn't seem, who are trampled in the wine press. As we keep reading, we discover that the enemies of God are the ones who drink the wine. They're the ones on which the wine is poured out. You'll have to check your notes, excuse me, that we don't have slides today, but it seems like the end of chapter 14, with its river of blood flowing from God's wine press, brings us to chapters 15 and 16, where we see seven great bowls of wine, bowls of wrath, being poured out, given to the enemies of God to drink. That's the way that God judges evil. He gives it more and more of its own wine. After the bowls of wine, in chapter 17, we're told that Lady Babylon was drunk on the blood of who? The blood of God's people, is what it says. And that chapter 18 looks back on the bowls of wrath, of everything that's happened so far, and it celebrates that God has poured her a double. God's poured her a double of her very own wine. It's like Lady Babylon's deeds follow her, too. She's getting what she wants and discovering that it's going to destroy her. So what are the grapes? What's the wine? 1600 stadia is some kind of symbolic number, if you couldn't tell. And it just happens to be the approximate length of the Promised Land. The land of Palestine. It's the length of the River Jordan. It's like it's a symbolic number for the people of God. Best I can tell, and I hold it with an open hand, it's God's people who are the grapes. Just as the people of God are the harvest, the people of God are the grapes. And the percussion section banging this drum really surprises us right here, because this is such a strange, unusual beat that they give us. It's really irregular timing. It's an unusual rhythm that they set for us in our own lives, but it's the rhythm of the cross. It's the vocation of the church. It's always the rhythm of how God saves the world. The people of God are victorious on Mount Zion. The people of God are harvested and safe and at rest, but the people of God are also crushed. It's like John is saying again in just yet another picture that our safety comes through sacrifice. Through following the Lamb wherever he goes. Jesus makes our blood like his. Blood poured out that will ultimately destroy evil and heal the world. Again and again in Revelation, especially here as the great symphony gets ready to play, John reminds us, he reminds the church of something really important, really crucial, that Jesus does not spare us from suffering. But Jesus does transform our suffering. He doesn't spare us from suffering, from being crushed. What he does is he transforms it. He changes it into the thing that's going to destroy evil itself. Maybe we all need to hear this morning as we come to the table. In times, I don't know where you guys are in your weeks or in your month or season of life, but in times when life is impossibly hard, when you don't know how you can move forward, in moments when it looks like evil is winning, is the way you say it, in seasons where it feels like we are being crushed, take heart. Be encouraged. Have faith. God saves the world by pouring out his own blood and by pouring out those who follow him. That's the way God saves the world. It's always the cross. It's the pattern of the cross. Evil defeated by painful love. The world healed by painful love. Following the Lamb wherever he goes does not mean that we get to avoid suffering in our lives, that we avoid getting crushed. In fact, it's basically the opposite. What Jesus gives us is his very own life. Always. Jesus' life was crushed for the life of the world. His blood poured out, flowing like a river, so that love can transform the world. That's what we're always being given. God's always giving us himself. That's what we are invited into the life of the Lamb. Even our suffering, even our struggle, our defeat, our feeling crushed, because maybe we actually are being crushed, somehow God takes all of it and transforms it into wine. The wine that's going to defeat evil and heal the world. the world in our lives, it sometimes feels like a disjointed, confusing racket. As we are longing and waiting for the symphony to start, as we're longing for Jesus to come and return and transform the world, maybe we should be praying less. Maybe I should be praying less that God would spare me from suffering and more that God would transform my suffering. For most of us, this calls for patient endurance. Maybe God is making wine out of our suffering. White hot, healing love that vanquishes evil and heals the world. Maybe Jesus is sharing his life with us. Until that great and glorious day when God strikes up the band and plays the symphony of love that makes all things new, may we be learning that secret song today. May you follow the Lamb wherever he goes, and may your deeds follow you. And may we trust that even our struggles, even our suffering, will be used to usher in God's new age of love.